The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
Our guest today is Joseph A. Morris, who was an assistant attorney general of the United States under President Ronald Reagan. Today, he practices law in Chicago, including election law. He has served for many years as a hearing officer for the Chicago Board of Elections, and he's presided over hearings held to determine the eligibility of both Chicago's former mayor, Rahm Emanuel, and its current mayor, Lori Lightfoot, to be on the ballot. He also serves as the chairman of the Heartland Institute, a Midwest-based organization that is one of the most important think tanks in America. Jay and I have worked a lot, of course, with Heartland. So welcome to the show, Joe.
My pleasure, Tom. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. So, Jay, you were going to ask Joe about the biggest problem in America about elections.
Before that, I want to jump in and get your reading of how did all we read about six states having very scurrilous election records, how did that get dismissed without an investigation? And why did the Supreme Court ignore it?
The short answer is that the people who tried to bring those cases did a terrible job of bringing them. They, despite the fact that they had months and months prior to the election and then weeks and weeks after the election to get their ducks in a row, to do their, to dig for evidence, to be prepared to find the evidence, to marshal their arguments and so forth, when the rubber met the road, they were much better at press conferences than they were at actually prosecuting lawsuits. They simply didn't marshal the evidence. They didn't marshal the facts. And it's a terrible thing when you go into court with all puffed up and making extensive claims, and then you don't have the facts to back them up. You start losing credibility very rapidly, and those cases deflated quickly. Looking back on it, of course there was election fraud. Of course there were mistakes that were made in the conduct of elections. The 2020 elections were not perfect. No elections ever are. And by the way, I don't think the promise of a democracy is that people get perfect elections. You get fair elections, honest elections. But our experience is that everywhere across the country from time to time, whether it's state by state or within states, locale by locale, cheating happens. And there are all kinds of ways to cheat. And every time somebody comes up with a way of cutting off or foreclosing the cheating, somebody finds a new way to do it. And there'll always be a little change this year in the election rules. We'll have some new rule. And it gives an advantage to one side of the professional political class or the other. One side or the other always masters the new rules or the new technology first, and then the other side catches up. Both sides are pretty good at cheating. Both sides are pretty good at learning how to change the rules of the game and taking advantage of those situations. And it happens in you know, state by state, locale by locale across the country. One of the great virtues, in my view, of the Electoral College system is it cabins those problems. You have an infection in one state of some kind of form of cheating or dishonesty or other, you know, mechanical problems, whether they're innocent or they're malignant. Those problems stay inside that state. At most, they're going to affect the outcome of those electoral votes. If we had a national simple count every single vote in the country and tote them all up, and whoever wins all the majority of the votes in the country rather than the Electoral College system wins, then we have to have recount every single precinct, every single district, every single state across the country anytime we have a question. This way we know the problem may be limited to this state or that state and so forth, and we can confine the necessary analysis to that place. That's one of the defects in H.R. 1, the bill that's pending in Congress right now, is terribly nationalized. It's an attempt to nationalize the conduct of elections that so far for nearly 250 years in American history have successfully been conducted by leaving the responsibility for the conduct of elections to the states.
You've given me one piece of information that was critical to me personally when you explained that they were very good at press conferences and they were not very good, you know, really when they got to court. And I've only been subjected to press conferences. I don't, you know, I'm not a lawyer and would not have understood what you just explained, but the press conferences were impressive to me, and now I understand why they were not effective. So they're actually trying to get rid of the Electoral College. I guess that's not exactly in H.R. 1 that we're discussing here, but I don't think it's any secret that they would like to get rid of the Electoral College. Is that correct?
Well, there are important constituencies in this country, mostly in the Democratic Party, that favor the abolition of the Electoral College and going to a straight majoritarian vote for the office of president. I think it's a huge mistake simply in relation to the mechanics of conducting elections. And I think it's a huge mistake in terms of what it does to the nature of our polity, to the nature of our federal system. Jay, I know you're a great baseball fan. You and I have known each other for a long time. I know you love baseball. I like to use the following illustration of how the Electoral College works and why it makes sense. And it's a very simple baseball analogy. Imagine we're playing the World Series, okay? And two teams, the Reds and the Blues. In the first game of the World Series, the Reds score 20 runs and the Blues score zero. And in the second game of the World Series, the Reds score zero and the Blues score one. And in the third game, the Reds score zero and the Blues score one. And the fourth game, the Reds score zero and the Blues score one. So now we've got four games, and the score in games is 3-1. And the next three games, the Reds, each game ends, the Reds one, the Blues zero, Reds one, Blues zero, Reds one, Blues zero. At the end of seven games, let's reverse the score in the last game. It's the Blues. Yeah. It's the Blues one, the Reds nothing. At the end of seven games, the score is Blues four games, Reds three games. But if you count up the runs, the Reds have scored 23 runs, and the Blues have scored four. Who wins the World Series? The team with the 23 runs or the team with the four games? And the answer is the team with the four games. That's the way the Electoral College works. The election is not decided. If you had half the voters in America living in California, California all by itself would not get to decide the election. This is a federal system where the people live by states, and each state is a political community, a little mini republic, a sovereign republic unto itself. There's a reason for that. The reason for that is that we want to encourage local communities, the solidarity of people at the local level where life happens. We want to encourage the states to be, as several of our great jurists like Louis Brandeis have said, laboratories of democracy, where people can try experiments with this kind of public policy or that kind of public policy and see if it works, rather than having to subject all 200-300 million Americans to being guinea pigs in some social policy experiment. You can try an experiment in policy change in one state and see if it makes an improvement in people's lives. If it does, other states can, or the national government can consider it. If it doesn't, you haven't poisoned everybody's life with a failed experiment. There's a lot to be said for a federal system, and one of the things it does is it requires politicians to go everywhere in the country, not just in the handful of high population states, but it requires them to campaign everywhere in the country, carry the explanations for their public policy choices to all the voters of the country. Yes, a handful of states in any given year may be identified that year as the swing states, but you know, as the decades go by, the identity of the swing states is going to rotate around the country, depending on the political makeup of the populace. And the current system has served us extremely well. There is nothing about abolishing the Electoral College that people advocate where they can point to any democracy of our size anywhere in the world that does it better. One of the things that we risk is destroying the two-party system. And I'm not sure that we'd want to have a situation as they had in Britain a couple of years ago where they couldn't form a majority government, or a situation where they're having in a wonderful democracy, Israel, right now, where they've had five elections in, the last two or three years and still having difficulty putting together a majority government. We don't have that problem in our constitutional system, and I think that is a good thing. Let me make one other argument of principle about this, which is to say we don't have, and we don't want to have, a pure democracy in America. When I say pure democracy, I mean a strict system of majority rule. There are some issues, some questions that we consciously, deliberately put beyond the decision of a majority. The majority may decide that you, Jay, ought to be a slave. Well, that's not their right. They shouldn't have the right to say by majority rule that slavery is okay. Of course, that was the rule. It was the majority rule problem that created the division between Abraham Lincoln and the Republicans on the one hand and Stephen Douglas and the Democrats on the other. Stephen Douglas campaigned for popular sovereignty. People ought to be able to vote on whether or not they can make other people slaves. We don't want that in America. We don't want the majority to be able to say you should have this religion or that religion is outlawed or your speech may be suppressed. We put some things beyond majority control by our constitutional rules. The last thing we want to do to preserve a free and democratic republic is to go down the path of starting to weaken the Constitution of the United States, the greatest bulwark against tyranny, frankly, in an effective and practical way that the world has ever seen.
I'm guessing that there are few listeners that have better understood the republic system and the importance of the Electoral College than they do right now. And your explanation was fabulous.
I really admire your system because in Canada, for example, right now, we have a minority government. We also have a situation where what people think west of Ontario doesn't matter to the federal government at all. They simply don't care. It's as if the people from the west and the middle part of Canada really have no voice because...
Well, that's true of the Maritimes too, isn't it? If you have a, if the Liberal Party of Quebec and the Liberal Party of Ontario make a deal at the national level, that settles all questions for everybody from BC to Prince Edward Island, right? There's nothing left.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that's driving a new separatist movement in Alberta, because
yes,
they don't like the fact that it's all being dictated from Ottawa.
Yes, well, I understand that. And my answer, Tom, is our arms should be open. If Alberta wants to become the 51st state of the Union, we should very seriously consider that with hospitality lights on.
Sadly, the current administration wants to get Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico as states to give themselves four more senators and more House members to ensure their majority. I might say that I'm an eternal optimist in this. And as while H.R. 1 changes the whole voting structure, which we'll talk more about, what is done can be undone. And I quite confident would be willing to bet a good deal of money that all the heinous things this administration is doing day after day is going to cost them both the House and the Senate 18 months from now when we vote in November of 2022. We're stuck with the president, but we're not going to be stuck with the Congress.
Well, I think that's right, Jay. And let me offer a pixie-ish set of views about Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia. First of all, it would be a travesty if the District of Columbia became a state, and that has nothing to do with whatever implications that might be on Electoral College voting or voting in the Senate or the House of Representatives. It is that when we set up the Republic, we did not want to subject people who live and work in the seat of government, the seat of the national government, to local pressures to favor local interests over the national interest. And so we said, wherever we locate the government, that the seat of the government, 10 miles square, is not going to have a vote in the formation of the government. In other words, we didn't want a system where the people in the capital controlled the entire country. Instead, we wanted the country to control the capital. And that's an important issue of principle. And let me also say, as a historical matter, if it's decided that the people of the District of Columbia ought to enjoy all of the privileges of state citizenship, and maybe they should, then the land that currently comprises the District of Columbia should be retroceded to the state that ceded it to the United States in the first place, and that was Maryland. Actually, when the District of Columbia was first created, it was exactly a 10-mile square diamond. Part of that, those 10 miles, were on the other side of the Potomac River, carved out of the state of Virginia. And at a certain point in the 19th century, it was decided that land was no longer needed for the seat of government, and it was retroceded back to the state of Virginia. If that should happen for the people of the District of Columbia, then it should be retroceded to the state of Maryland. And maybe you have this little tiny enclave where the government actually meets in what is today downtown Washington, D.C., but that should not be in any state. With respect to Puerto Rico, if the people of Puerto Rico want to trade off their fabulous current status, under which they are citizens of the United States with full access, without passport, to come in and out of the United States, the rest of the United States, at will, They have access to all of the rights that are guaranteed to citizens of the United States under the Constitution of the United States. They have access to the federal courts in either the English or the Spanish language. But one thing they don't have to do is they don't have to pay federal income taxes. The people of Puerto Rico are American citizens who do not have to pay federal income taxes. If the people of Puerto Rico join the United States as the 51st state, Puerto Rico being the 51st state, and they become taxpayers, I guarantee you within a generation, Puerto Rico will be a solid Republican state. The one law that Democrats in Congress will never be able to repeal is the law of unintended consequences.
Yeah, I fully agree. Let me ask you a question about H.R. 1. I know your opinion is that it doesn't solve any problem. I think it makes a lot of problems. But one of the things that puzzles me is how can they make it illegal for the states to require a photo ID? You can't do anything in this country other than vote without a photo ID. I don't understand what their reasoning is or why they think this is important.
Oh, it's smoke and mirrors. First of all, you're asking the question, how can they do it? They can do it because although the Constitution generally confides the management of federal elections. So there's elections for federal offices, and there are only four federal offices. That is the office of president, the office of vice president, the office of senator. There are currently 100 of those, and the office of representative. There are 435 of those. Those federal offices are elected under federal rules. First of all, the federal constitution, the ground rules that it sets up. And then the responsibility is assigned to the states to conduct elections, because the states are also republics conducting their own elections for their own offices, state and local offices. And elections, it turns out, are very expensive things to run. There's a lot of work that the voters don't see before election day involving the process of who gets on the ballot. People pass petitions and file their nominating papers, which get scrubbed and scrutinized, and other voters get the chance to challenge them and so forth. And there's this whole apparatus of hearings and litigation and so forth over who gets on the ballot in any given year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the ballots need to be made up. And whether the ballots are printed or the ballots are computerized and on machines, they need to be prepared, and the machines need to be programmed and so forth. If you live in any the typical county, you know, on an election day, you're voting for federal office, you may be voting for president, vice president, senator, representative in Congress. You'll be voting for a governor, a secretary of state, a lieutenant governor, an attorney general of your state. You'll be voting for a mayor, a county commissioner, a state senator, a state representative. You'll be voting for maybe a circuit judge. You'll be voting for a library commissioner. You'll be voting for a school board member and so forth. And within the county, within the city, maybe even within the precinct, there will be people who live in one set of, I'm voting for this state rep, but I'm voting. But my neighbor across the street's in a different state representative district voting for that state representative. And so all kinds of different variations on the ballot have to be prepared, even for local elections, especially for local elections, to let people vote for the officials who are going to represent and govern them. So there's a huge amount of work that goes into preparing the ballots. And very little of that work is involved in the federal elections. What happens, of course, as a practical matter, is the federal elections happen like clockwork because of the on a uniform national basis, because we're electing our president and our senators and our congressmen at the same time every year everywhere in the country. So what that naturally leads the states and localities to do is to hold their own elections at the same time the federal elections are held, because it saves money, right? You don't have to do two elections or two primaries and two general elections in the year. You just do one of each, and you combine the federal and the state elections at the same time. And that makes an enormous amount of sense and makes a tremendous savings for the taxpayers who are footing the bill, who are, for the most part, the state and local taxpayers. The Congress gets the idea that if we have the authority under the Constitution to override the states when it comes to some of the mechanics of holding the federal elections, and the nifty little deal here is that Congress knows that if they change the rules for the federal elections, the states are going to throw up their hands and say, well, we can't afford to run our own elections separately, so we'll have to run our elections in lockstep with the federal elections and so forth. And that's how Congress sneakily gets to be able to control all elections and not just the elections that the Constitution makes them entitled to control if they really assert their way. And so that's how Congress gets to do it. Let there be no doubt about what the agenda is. And this goes, this message, let me say this in the ear and mind of every listener, anytime anybody, Democrat or Republican, congressman or state legislator, comes along and tells you he wants to sell you a package of election law reforms, get your guard up. Because chances are, 99 times out of 10, what the people proposing quote-unquote reforms have in mind is some jiggering of the mechanics of the election that's going to favor their team the next time or times out. And we see that. I sit here, I'm in Chicago at this moment. I'm a Chicagoan. We have pioneered and invented more forms of election fraud than you can imagine. I've seen it in my lifetime over and over again. Massive election fraud. Fortunately, it doesn't affect the full country because of the electoral college system when we come to presidential elections. But I've seen massive election fraud right under my nose, and it's a constantly evolving thing. The one party puts in a certain number of rules that they have anticipated. They see them coming. They know how to master them. And in this election cycle, they got the leg up because they know how to game those rules. But you know what? The other party watches this happen. They say, we see what's going on there. We can do that too. Last year, the other guys did ballot harvesting. Okay, we'll gear up. We'll get ready to do ballot harvesting. Last year, the other guys learned how to raise more money through the tweaking they did in the campaign finance laws. Oh, we see how they set up their new legal structures to raise more money. Well, we can do that too. And so next year, the competition gets better at it than the people who founded the so-called reform. So somebody's got to change the rules again. Because it's a game. It's a cat and mouse game where the professional politicians are constantly looking for some strategic or tactical advantage that allows them in a particular local context to get a leg up on the competition. That's what is usually happening in most so-called election law reform, and that is what's happening in H.R. 1 massively. It is a massive attempt by the currently in power Democrats to game the system, so they hope with the 2022 and 2024 elections, they will have a huge leg up on the Republican competition that will let them sail through for a couple more election cycles before the Republicans get smart and figure out how to use the same tools more effectively than the Democrats have done. And by the way, that will happen, and then it will be back to the races again.
Well, the one that really interests me most that we should take up as soon as we start the next segment, Tom, is the idea of 16-year-olds voting in school under the direction of their teacher. That will be amazing.
Well, you will be taking a break for a commercial, and when we get back, we'll talk about that. 16-year-olds having votes under the guidance of their teachers, of course, who are predominantly Democrat supporters. And I also had a couple of questions for Joe that I'm hoping we can address for some listeners who may not know what ballot harvesting is. It'd be important to talk about that. And I'd also like to get back to this question of voter ID pictures, because indeed we're hearing in Canada, and it's something I don't understand, we're hearing that this somehow prejudices against people of color. And yet everybody I know who's in that category, they all have IDs with their picture on it. We'll be right back after the break.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
The America Out Loud family is comprised of patriots in the true sense of the word. We know that if America fails, the world will fail. it is incumbent upon us to carry the torch for liberty and the Constitution to help save America for future generations to come. AmericaOutloud.com. It's a fight for the soul of humanity.
Okay, welcome back to the show. We were just talking before the break about voter ID and about elections where 16-year-olds can vote, but I think we got that second point a little wrong. Joe, could you explain what H.R. 1 really says about 16-year-olds?
Sure. What H.R. 1 does in the name of getting young people prepared to be active voters, making democracy safe for young people, it authorizes public school teachers in classrooms, the federal government reaching into the classrooms of local schools and saying, no matter what local school officials tell you, we're turning local classroom school teachers, especially in public schools. The definitions here are clearly aimed at public secondary schools. We're turning public school teachers into voter registrars, going down to the age of 16, so that public school teachers will be allowed to register voters at the age of 16. They may not be able to vote until they reach the age of 18 in lawful elections, but they can register to vote. And it doesn't take a real genius to realize that this is a tremendous gift to the public school teachers unions coast to coast, a major, probably the single most important constituency, certainly providing muscle at the local level of the Democratic Party around the United States, probably the most important financial constituency of the Democratic Party are the trial lawyers, but the most important muscle constituency in most locales are the public unions, and especially the most powerful of them, the teachers' unions. Imagine if you're in a state where voter registration is a partisan matter. Some states, voter registration is nonpartisan. You sign up to be on the voter rolls, and you don't have to declare a party. If you don't vote in a primary election, you don't have to declare your party ever. You go into the polling place in the November election, the fall, the general election, and you don't have to declare a party. You go in and you pick the candidate you want to vote without telling anybody. It's none of their business what party you're going to vote for in the general election. But a primary election is an internal election within a party. So if you're going to vote in a primary election, you have to declare a party. But some states have partisan registration to begin with. You register to vote by declaring yourself as a member of a party at the outset. There's no such thing as nonpartisan registration. You're a Democrat, a Republican, something else, or an independent. So imagine what this is in a 16-year-old's social studies class where the local steward of the teachers' union says, "All right, kids, you're going to register to vote. We've been talking about elections and democracy and how important it is for your futures. This is for real. You're going to sign a card here that's going to go to the election authority, and it's going to put you on the roll. So the day you turn 18, you'll be eligible to vote. And I'm going to help you do it and do it right and get your card in." Now, in our state, when you fill out this card, you've got to check a box that says you're a member of a political party. Now, what political party are you going to be in? Are you going to be in the party of the good guys like me, or are you going to be in the party of the scoundrels like them? You can see that that opportunity for propagandizing that should never take place in schooling. Tom, you've been raising the question about ballot harvesting. Let me go to that, because I think that there's a direct connection here between ballot harvesting and this question of privacy or of secrecy. We have taken it for 150 years in America that the idea of a secret ballot is a sacred thing. You're a Canadian, Tom, right?
Right. Yep. I'm born and brought up in Montreal.
You live under La Reine, Queen, Elizabeth II, by the grace of God, Queen of Canada. Most Americans also, of course, think of her as the Queen of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. But there are many other places of which she is Queen, and one of them is she is the Queen of Australia. And our fellow Earthlings down under, back in the 19th century, really impressively went to bat for the proposition of the secret vote. The idea that the way votes are conducted, voting and elections are conducted, should be conducted in such a way that the voter goes into a polling place or in some way casts his or her ballot in such a way that nobody else on earth knows how that ballot was cast. It's your business between you and God and your conscience how you voted. And that system of secrecy of the ballot, the sacred secret ballot, became known to the world in the 19th century and in America as the Australian ballot.
Oh.
And in fact, it's often called that in the laws of many states around the United States. We have the Australian ballot system. This is where voter ID and voter harvesting and all that all come into play. They are all aimed at preserving the secrecy of your ballot. The secrecy of the ballot is something that professional politicians hate. They hate it here in Chicago. That's the way the Chicago machine has worked for generations.
Yeah.
If you're going to keep your job with the city, you cast an absentee ballot, but before you mail that absentee ballot in, you bring your absentee ballot to the ward committeeman or your precinct captain, and you let him check it. You show him your ballot, that you're voting the right way. That way you keep your job. If you don't show up with your ballot, God forbid if you cast the ballot wrong, but at least if you bring it in, he gives you an opportunity to correct it. But if you don't bring the ballot in and show it to the ward boss or the precinct captain, you may lose your job in Chicago in the 1960s under Richard J. Daley. That's the way it worked. Imagine that everybody is casting an absentee ballot. That's what early voting and voting by mail often is. It's everybody casting an absentee ballot. That creates opportunities for people to pass out the ballots, people to say, well, before you cast your ballot, make sure I see it. Now, you know, where does that pressure come from? Does it come from within the family? Does it come from the job? Does it come from the precinct captain? Does it come from somebody you're trying to influence or somebody who's got influence over you? It is a way of undermining the secrecy of the ballot. The next question is, how do we make sure if you're casting a secret ballot, nobody knows that you've cast the ballot? How do we know that when the ballot comes in to be counted, that the ballot is yours and not something that somebody else has stuffed in? A very important principle of American democracy is the one person, one vote rule, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets a vote, one vote. Your vote counts, but you don't get to cast one vote and I get to cast two. We each get to cast only one vote. So how do we make sure that every vote is cast by and only by a voter who's entitled to cast it and nobody's monkeying with that system? We have to have some way of connecting the ballot with the voter who's entitled to cast it, right? That's perfectly logical, especially it's going to be secret. If we're having a New England town meeting, if we're going to be like the yeoman in New Hampshire, and when we elect our mayor, we're all going to gather in the biggest barn in town and have a debate and then have a show of hands. Who's for Jeb for mayor and who's for Cy? And that's not a secret ballot. We're raising our hands and so forth. But if you're going to have a secret ballot, you've got to connect the ballot with the voter. Now, the traditional easy way to connect the ballot with the voter in America for the last 150 years has been the simple process of having a polling place on election day, one day, election day. And on election day, I walk out of my house, I walk down the street to the school or the fire station or the church on the corner, which has been set up for that day as my polling place. I walk in and there are a couple of my neighbors, one Democrat, a couple Democrats, a couple Republicans who are the election judges. Hello, Joe, they say. They pull out the binder that has the list of registered voters in it. I sign my application for a ballot. They probably know who I am, but they go through the motions of checking my signature against the signature on my voter registration card. Yep, that's Joe Morris. They say, give him his ballot. And I walk into a booth. And if it's a paper ballot, I fill it out. And I come out having filled out the ballot. I don't show it to anybody. Under their watchful eyes, I and only I put it in the slot, and boom, my ballot is cast, not to be seen again until it's counted, and nobody knows that that particular ballot was the one that I cast, right? Or yeah, if I'm voting on an election machine, a similar mechanical process, but I walk in, I close the curtain, I cast my vote on the machine. When the votes are counted, nobody knows that any particular vote was the one that I cast, but everybody knows that I physically was there and cast a vote. And that simple mechanics of physically walking into a polling place on election day, we have a system for connecting each voter, each one voter, to each one vote. And we know that if 55 voters walked in the door, there better not be 56 votes in the machine, right?
Right.
Or in the ballot box. So we have that simple check and balance. Now, in the modern age, when we want to, and particularly in a pandemic year, when we want to make voting as convenient for people as possible, we have early voting and we have voting by mail, which is effectively absentee ballot voting for everybody. How do we connect that ballot, which is going to go somehow from me to the election authority, how do we connect that ballot with me so that everybody knows that that ballot has been cast by an authorized registered voter, but without having the ballot seen by anybody, so that it remains a sacred, secret ballot? And the usual mechanics for that is we put my ballot inside a sealed envelope. And the envelope has my name or some identifier, something connecting me with the election system. So when the envelope comes in, it's the envelope that passes muster. And if everybody says, yep, that envelope has come in from a valid registered voter, the whatever vote is enclosed inside that envelope should be counted, then we slit open the envelope, then we separate the ballot from the envelope without looking at it, put the ballot in the pile to be counted anonymously. And so we've had a legitimate one person, one vote arrangement. So how do we connect me on the outside of that envelope with my right to vote? And we need my name. How do we prove that somebody's not casting that ballot in my name without me actually doing it? And so up to this point, we've used signatures. We people sign the outside of their ballot envelope. And then we have this process at election headquarters of comparing the signature on the envelope with the signature in the voter registration card. And it's gotten very technically sophisticated these days. It's computerized. So the envelope comes in, it's been pre-printed with a computer code on it, like a barcode. And that brings up automatically on a computer screen my registration card, and the election judges can compare my signature on the outside of my envelope with my registration signature. Sometimes it's a subjective thing, but most of the time it works. Can we reduce the subjectivity of the identification? Sure, by using something like my driver's license number or my social security number or some other identifier. In the same way, when I walk into the polling place and I'm confronted by a couple of local election judges, these good citizens who get up early on election day to go run the polls for the rest of us, and they don't know me by name, and because in a highly mobile society, maybe they won't, and they're not real good at comparing my signature today as it was a couple of decades ago when I was a kid and I signed my voter registration card for the first time, and my signature looks a lot different these days than it might have done then. So instead of having to fight those subjective battles, how about if I use the same ID that I use to get a prescription or to get a benefit from a government office or to get into a government building through the security system or to board an airplane? How about if I use that same picture ID, passport, my driver's license, my inexpensive given away by the state for nothing, the official state ID? How about if I use that to identify myself if, for example, my signature requires too subjective a judgment? Why don't the professional pals want that? Because the professional pals want every opportunity they can get to look at your ballot. And that brings us then to ballot harvesting. What's ballot harvesting? Tom, you're going to cast your ballot. Listen, don't worry yourself. Don't go to the post office. Don't worry worse about taking your ballot all the way downtown to the election authority. I'm going to be by your house on Tuesday afternoon. I'll be glad to pick up your ballot for you, and I'll take it downtown for you, says the precinct captain, your very friendly neighborhood precinct captain, whose job depends on his ability to harvest votes. So what happens when you and 500 other people turn over your ballots to a ballot harvester who's going to do you the great favor of walking in and taking your ballot to the election authority? How do you know? How does anybody know? How could you ever know that he didn't take your envelope, slit open your envelope, and see how you voted? And if you voted the wrong way, simply undertook the simple expedient of putting your vote in the trash. What check and balance is there against that? What check and balance is there against the possibility that the ballot harvester, looking at your ballot, noticed that you didn't vote for his friend Smith for judge, but the good news is you didn't vote in that election at all. It's a completely blank part of your ballot. Well, he can cast the vote for you. What check and balance is there to prevent him from doing that? How do you know he didn't do it? How do the election authorities know he didn't do it? The great danger with ballot harvesting is that it puts somebody between the voter and the putting of that vote in the anonymously and secretly in the box where the votes are going to be counted, such that somebody can cast your vote for you or deny you the right to vote at all. That's what's really at stake here. It's really denying the voter the right to vote at all or the right to vote secretly.
And they wouldn't have the option of resealing the ballot back into the envelope? or do they even go, or does it just go straight?
Sure, sure. I mean, sure. You don't think they haven't figured out how to do that?
Oh, okay.
unseal envelopes and reseal them again? Of course they know how to do that. That's a piece of cake.
Now,
Don't underestimate the professional political class. When their jobs depend on it, they figure out how to do it.
Now, back to the question of photo ID. How does that prejudice against people of color? Sitting here in Canada, I can't see why that would be the case.
The usual explanations that the Democrats give are typically very racist. And the explanation is reduced to one or another version of the theme that people of color are too stupid or too lazy or too unmotivated to be able to go out and get IDs. That there's something onerous and dreadful and frightening about getting IDs. That Hispanic people are afraid to go out to government offices to get IDs because it exposes them to being harassed by immigration authorities. In the first place, the only people in America who should be casting votes are citizens. I mean, that's the nature of a democracy, right? We govern ourselves. We don't have other people govern us. Citizens govern each other. So if you're a citizen, you've got nothing to fear from the immigration authorities, except bad manners, I suppose. But we're exposed to bad manners by government employees and bureaucrats in all walks of life and all agencies every day of the week. The argument is that it's simply just too darn onerous to expect people of color to be able to get all the necessary to be able to get a proper government ID. How absurd is that? First of all, it is a racist, demeaning argument about the inability, the incapacity of people to do something that they're, of course, perfectly capable and prepared to do. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they do mm-hmm. because all of us, whether we're driving cars or we're going into office buildings or public office buildings, or we're going into the hospital or we're getting medical care, we have to show that we are who we are. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a national ID system. We have lots and lots of different ID systems that people will accept, ranging from driver's license and other state IDs to U.S. passports to well-done IDs that are issued by our schools or our employers and that people have come generally to accept because they're trustworthy and they're easy to get. And they lubricate the system and make sure that a benefit is being conferred or a burden is being imposed only on the person who ought to be subject to that benefit or that burden.
Joe, my reading of H.R. 1 says it's illegal to ask a voter if they are a citizen. Is that correct?
That is correct. And of course, that's obnoxious because citizenship is the sine qua non of being a voter. People who are not citizens in this country have lots and lots of rights. The Constitution protects everyone in the United States. The doctrine, the idea of the equal protection of the laws enshrined in our 14th Amendment applies to everybody subject to the laws of the United States, citizen or not. And by the way, non-citizens are also subject to the burdens of residents in the United States, such as taxation and obeying our laws. The one thing above all others that citizenship confers upon the citizen is the right to be a decision maker, a political decision maker. Citizenship is admission to the club that lets you vote on who's going to hold office and in referenda to vote on what's going to be the law. That's the nature of a democracy. If we're going to govern ourselves, we have to know who we are. And the definition of we-ness is citizenship. And if there's any question that is a legitimate question for asking anybody who's going to be an elector, who's going to try to govern us, it is, are you one of us? That is, are you a citizen? That's a fundamental bedrock question. And what H.R. 1 is trying to do here is to undermine the connection between citizenship and voting.
Well, isn't this unconstitutional? I mean, the thing, I read the bill, I would think that it could go to the Supreme Court and be thrown out as unconstitutional, although I have less and less confidence in the Supreme Court. But what is your opinion about the bill being unconstitutional?
I'm sorry, but now you are putting me into a terrible bind, a tremendous conflict of interest. Because remember, not only am I a citizen and a political advocate, I'm also a lawyer. And H.R. 1, I guarantee you, is going to guarantee lots and lots of business for lawyers for the next several years. There are so many things in H.R. 1 that cry out to be litigated. The country will be papered coast to coast with lawsuits. There are lots of hidden time bombs, lots of hidden things in H.R. 1 that are just obnoxious. Right now, if we have a fight in Ohio, where Jay is, I think, or in Illinois, where I am, over the right way to conduct an election, we go to our local courts. I walk down the street to my courthouse. I file my lawsuit against my local election authority. If H.R. 1 passes and I have a fight with my local election authority, and I want to sue my election authority over some issue, I can't just walk down the street to my local courthouse. I have to go sue my election, my Chicago election authority in Washington, D.C. Yes, you hear me right. H.R. 1 confers upon the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia national jurisdiction over all election disputes. I'm not making that up. That's an outrage. There's nothing about election litigation that cries out for concentrating election decision-making in one court in the country that doesn't require that much technical expertise. These are questions of ordinary statutory construction and interpretation of the Constitution, which presumably every single federal judge at the district court level or the Court of Appeals level, let alone the Supreme Court level, should be competent at doing, reading federal statutes and reading the U.S. Constitution. So this is going to make it perhaps the nature of my conflict of interest as a lawyer is a little bit different. This is going to create a tremendous lot of work for the D.C. bar, but not so much for election lawyers everywhere else around the country, unless, of course, our clients are willing, rich enough to pay for us to get on the plane and fly to Washington, D.C. to try these cases. But I do a lot of election work in Illinois, outside of Chicago, where I sit as a hearing officer, and it's pretty economical. The local courts are reasonably inexpensive, and they're accessible to the people. People can show up for their own hearings in election cases when they're heard in local courts. And H.R. 1, again, for the benefit of nobody other than the political classes in Washington, D.C., continuing to concentrate power in Washington, D.C., it transfers the locus of decision-making in the judicial arena as well to Washington, D.C. That's part of the nonsense that's baked into this bill.
20 attorney generals, I understand, have gathered together and made some complaint about this bill. Is that going to have any standing at all?
I think it will. When you say 20 attorneys general, you're talking about attorneys general of the states.
Yes, yes.
Because each state is a sovereignty with its own constitution, its own election laws, its own elections that it needs to conduct, and the attorney general in each state is the chief legal officer of that state. And there are several dozen of them who are disquieted by this legislation and who recognize the threat it has to the states, not only in terms of the sovereign authority of the states, not only in terms of the welfare of state voters, but also the concerns of state taxpayers. It's going to impose tremendous new costs. It's like a federal mandate. Congress saying, well, we want to do this and that and that, and by the way, you're going to pay for it. Congress is not going to tax people for to raise this money. You're going to have to tax people to raise the money. You'll have to take the blame for raising your taxes to spend the money in the way we're telling you to spend it. So all kinds of those issues are being bundled up by the attorneys general, and they're getting ready to litigate these issues if Congress passes and the president signs this bill. Fortunately, I think it's still a horse race. There are several Democratic senators who are really rather sensible and honorable people who realize the nature of the game, that this is a game being conducted for the benefit of the political class, not for the benefit of the people. And they're smart enough to say, well, okay, I see what Nancy Pelosi and the guys in the back room are doing here. They're gaming the 2022 election. But we set these rules in place for the 2022 election. And who's to say that by the time 2024 comes around, as has happened so many times in the past, when we've changed the rules of the game, for example, with respect to federal campaign finance, one party adopts a set of new rules and the other party figures out how to use them better. What's to say we adopt these rules for 2022, it's not going to come back to bite us in the rear end in 2024, a presidential year, when the Republicans around the country figured out how to use these new rules, the professional Republican pals, and trust me, there are professional Republican pals who are just as snaky as the professional Democratic pals. Trust me, they'll figure out how to use these rules even better than the professional Democrats do. The law of unintended consequences is something that always has to give people in the professional political classes pause. The American people are truly being disserved here. They've been taking it on the chin for the last couple of election cycles. We have a huge problem in this country that the American people don't have confidence that they're getting honest and fair elections.
Exactly.
And the heat rather than the light that's been shed on this. Let's go back to 2016. In 2016, there are all these allegations of Russian collusion. Now, were foreign powers or foreign governments been trying to interfere in American politics? You bet. And they were doing it in 2016, and they did it in 2012, and they did it in 2008, and they did it in 2004, and they've been doing it as long as I've been alive.
Uh-huh.
Foreign powers realizing that they can interfere in American activity by trying to mess up our elections and pit American against American. They've been doing that for years. They were doing that back in the Nazi era, time before World War II. In 2016, it was taken to a new level. The allegation was not just that the Russians are trying to interfere, but that one of the candidates is in cahoots with them. The collusion meant that Donald Trump was colluding with the Russian government to try to affect the outcome of the election. And it was a lie. It was a lie. It was a total lie. It was based on fabricated crap that was generated for pay by people in the pay of the Clinton campaign. And it was propagated by a handful of, in my view, corrupt public officials who ran with it and played with it because they were trying to influence the outcome of the election. And did we ever see law enforcement officials interfere more in an election than we saw in 2016? It was a scandal. It almost made the United States of America look a banana republic to have the director of the FBI deciding, this and that or another thing about candidates in the election. And then we had a compliant news media that ran with the story, and it was totally phony. Mm-hmm. And it poisoned the atmosphere for sure the first year of Donald Trump's administration, and seemed to affect his psychology profoundly. He's constantly fighting a rearguard action about the question of whether or not he colluded with the Russians. Totally false and totally poisonous to the American body politic. And then in 2020, we have the false allegation that the election was stolen. Yes, there was corruption. Yes, there were mistakes. Yes, there were ballots that were stolen and low-level local election fraud here, there, and everywhere across the country, as happens in every election. I see it in Chicago every cycle. But did it change the outcome of the election? I don't think it did, and I don't think we've seen any proof to date that it did. That's a lie that obviously has riled the American people and made the American people yet again distrust the conduct of the election. Enough is enough. The problem we have right now is the American people don't think that they have that their vote matters because it's not an honest count. And both the Democrats and the Republicans have been playing this game, and it's got to stop. We cannot have a democracy if people don't have confidence that their vote will count. I do firmly believe that there are some, mostly on the left, who are consciously trying to undermine democracy. The people do not have faith in democracy because these are the progressives. The progressives believe in government by experts. They don't want government by the people. They want government by experts who know what's best for you, whether it's in the area of the environment or in the environment of healthcare. You should not be making decisions for yourself. You should let the experts make decisions for you, and that process should begin with government. You should not be making decisions on who's going to govern you. Your government should be choosing you rather than the other way around.
That's probably the best definition of what a progressive is that I've ever heard. They're people that think they're experts that can run your life far better than you can run your life.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is not new. I mean, it goes back to 2008 and Barack Obama's condemnation of the United States Constitution because it dwells too much on negative rights protecting you against the government instead of on positive rights. He wants to rewrite the Constitution to lard it with positive rights, things you're entitled to get from the government. But it goes way back beyond Barack Obama, 100 years before that, to Woodrow Wilson, the granddaddy of the progressives. Yes, the racist, segregationist Woodrow Wilson, the first, right, the founder of the American progressive movement, the most penetrating left-wing movement in American history, founded by Woodrow Wilson, who despised the Constitution of the United States. He wrote about it as an academic, as a professor of political science, as president of Princeton University, as governor of New Jersey, as president of the United States. He railed against the Constitution of the United States as outmoded and outdated because it had too darn many checks and balances. And what was needed was a system that allowed the experts chosen by the president and the other wise people to tell other people how to live their lives. The progressive movement that was set in motion by Woodrow Wilson back in the early 20th century continues its long arm reach through history. It's married its interests with the analytical methods of the modern 20th and 21st century Marxists and movements of the so-called Frankfurt School, the Marcuse and others, and homegrown American agitators to undermine the faith of the people in our constitutional system. Well, yeah. The dirty little secret of the progressives is that the progressive movement always has to have enemies. the identity of the enemy has changed depending on what the needs of the movement are in any particular moment in its efforts to grasp for power. Back in Woodrow Wilson's era, the enemy of the progressive movement were black people and people of color, because they were easy to trample on in an effort to build a majority of support for the progressives, who were reaching for any constituency they could that would support their efforts to take power. So they picked their enemies, and they picked their underclass, and they ran with it. Other great progressive experiments, of course, have included prohibition. That was a progressive effort. The movement that birthed Planned Parenthood, for example, the eugenics movement, to forbid some people from marrying or having children, whether it was across racial lines or ethnic lines or because of the health or genetic and so forth, to take control of people's lives to that degree, is a progressive impulse. The fundamental progressive impulse is to control other people's lives. We know better than people do. Thomas Jefferson spoke of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, meaning that each individual got to define for herself or himself what happiness is. That doesn't cut it with the progressives. They have no use for that vision of the Declaration of Independence and the American Constitution. They want to vest power across the board in experts, and the vesting of power in the people who know the right thing to do at any given moment has to begin with controlling elections. Then it goes on from controlling elections to controlling everything else.
Well, yeah. Tom and I talk a lot about climate change and global warming. It's all about power. It's just a mechanism in which they feel they can control our lives by controlling all the energy we use and all carbon dioxide emissions. And it has nothing to do with science. It has nothing to do with climate. It's all about power.
Well, that's right. And if you listen carefully to them, they admit it. They will say to you, we need to impose the following restrictions and the following requirements. Now, if we impose those restrictions, we impose those requirements, if you listen carefully, they'll tell you they won't make a difference in the climate. They won't move the needle a hair.
Uh-huh, exactly.
So why do it if it's not going to change anything on the ground or in the atmosphere actually affecting the climate? The answer is it's not the outcome in terms of the climate we care about. It's the outcome in terms of power we care about. The name of the game, it's a fig leaf. It's smoke and mirrors. It's intended simply to justify a seize of power, a seizure of power. It's not intended to address genuine climate issues.
Yeah. Tom and I have an article posted in America Out Loud right now, and we describe exactly that, relating H.R. 1 to climate change.
That was a tremendous summary from Joe Morris, who was Assistant Attorney General of the United States under President Ronald Reagan. He's now the chairman of the Heartland Institute, which people can check out at heartland.org, and I encourage people to do that. As I say, that was a tremendous summary of what the problems with H.R. 1 are. Let's hope that there's some sensible Democrats who will vote against it. So this is Tom Harris and Jay Lear and our guest, Joe Morris, signing out from The Other Side of the Story.